Welcome to What She Said on 105.9 The Region. I'm your host, Candace Sampson. As March hurtles towards April, bringing with it a final blast of cold and snow, we're all looking forward to the promise of spring. Despite the chill, though, it's the perfect time to warm up with a hot beverage and join me for an hour of engaging and thought-provoking discussions. This week on What She Said, we're exploring a mix of urgent issues and inspiring stories, from the dark world of sex trafficking to the personal journeys of discovery and the safe havens that offer sanctuary. Here's what's coming up. We begin with a deeply moving conversation with Alexandra Ford, whose journey from the shadows of sex trafficking to becoming a formidable advocate for its victims is nothing short of inspirational. Her courage and dedication to change are a beacon of hope for many. Anne Brody is back with her latest entertainment picks, including a heartfelt documentary on the legendary William Shatner in Call Me Bill, a poignant exploration of the immigrant experience in Queen of My Dreams, and a fresh take on crime drama with Homicide from the mastermind behind Law and Order. Then we meet Liz Long, who shares her enlightening journey of self-discovery following a late-in-life ADHD diagnosis. Her story, detailed in her upcoming book, offers a powerful message of resilience and self-acceptance that's sure to resonate with many. We'll also take a peek into the compassionate world of Storybook Farm Primate Sanctuary, a place of refuge and healing for primates endorsed by none other than Dr. Jane Goodall herself. It's a testament to the sanctuary's vital role in providing a second chance to these beautiful creatures. And in these times of economic uncertainty, Laura Whiteland joins us to shed light on navigating personal finances with savvy and grace. Her expert advice on budgeting amidst inflation is timely and invaluable for maintaining financial well-being without sacrificing quality of life. So join me for the next hour and let's explore these compelling narratives together, right here on 105.9 The Region. It's touching me. Every time you're loving me. I get stronger every day. In today's top interview, we're looking at the harrowing world of sex trafficking, a reality far too many have endured in silence. Alexandra Ford, a beacon of resilience and an advocate for change, joins me to share her own journey from the depths of exploitation to becoming a leading voice in the fight against human trafficking. Welcome to What She Said, Alexandra.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Do you mind sharing with us what motivated you to share your story and what impact you hope it will have?
I was trafficked in Ontario in 2007, and I didn't find out I was trafficked until just over 10 years later. And in that 10 years, I had escaped my trafficker. He had found me. We'd gone through a criminal trial. I had gone to school, like gone to post-secondary, gotten a degree in criminology, another one in victimology. I was doing my master's in psychology. I'd worked in domestic violence shelters. I'd worked with male youth in conflict with the law. The reason I share all that is because I was like really living, working, existing in the heart of the world where someone should really understand what trafficking is, what it looks like, know what happened to me and be able to label it correctly. And up until a chance meeting with a new friend who, you know, I heard she was doing anti-trafficking work and I was like, I know nothing about human trafficking, but I have all this school and work experience, so I would love to volunteer with you. And when I started sharing a bit of my story with her, she turned to me and said, you know, what you're describing to me sounds a lot like human trafficking. And I remember laughing at her and saying, no, it's not that. That's, you know, that's a really big deal thing. What happened to me was just, I'll put that in quotation marks, but just domestic violence and like a series of my own bad choices.
Right.
And she explained to me, you know, what made it human trafficking. And that was this like aha moment of, oh my God, I have been blaming myself for 10 years for something that wasn't my fault. Now I need everyone else to have this information.
So you've spoken about the subtle art of grooming by traffickers. For listeners who may not be familiar, can you explain what grooming looks like and how individuals can recognize and protect themselves from it?
Yes. So there's 5 stages of grooming. And rather than get into sort of all the exact technicalities of that, what I want to share about grooming is that it is insidious. It is not obvious. And predators don't only groom their victims. Typically, if they have access to their victim's support people, family members, friends, they will groom them as well. Now, grooming doesn't just mean getting them to a point where they can touch them inappropriately or, you know, sell them or something like that. It means molding them to fit the worldview that they want them to. They want them to feel in love with them, maybe, or indebted to them. And so what's what I mean when I say they'll groom their family and friends as well, is they're going to, that's why you always hear people say like, oh, Bob, but he was so nice. He was always, right, you know, the first guy to help out or something like that. It's because he has not only groomed his victim to feel whatever it was, like they were in a relationship with him or indebted to him or scared of him, but he groomed the entire neighborhood per se to think he was this super nice, really helpful guy. So when we look at signs of grooming, especially when we're talking about, you know, how do I notice if something like this is happening to my child, for example, or even to me?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the most commonly used like forms of grooming or methods of grooming is love bombing. It's this idea of just showering someone with love, and specifically the type of love that they need. So when you have, I can give you an example, a kid who has an older sibling who is a star athlete and parents, you know, happy family, but parents have a lot, their extra time really goes to the star athlete. And so this kid is looking for attention. They are looking for maybe a parental figure to tell them they're proud of them or to ask questions about their likes and dislikes and all of that. That might be what this person does. If it's a kid who, you know, is their family struggles financially and they never have the new iPhone or the cool shoes or anything like that, maybe someone will show up and buy them this thing that they've never would have thought they could own. And that will be love bombing. It'll feel like love to them.
Can you talk a little bit about the turning point then that led you to this advocacy that you're doing?
It was, for me, that conversation. I'd always been an advocate. I was an advocate from a really young age. And I was assaulted. I was sexually assaulted as a child, which led me down the path to where I ended up meeting the man who trafficked me. Then, as I said, I ended up escaping and going to school. And it was this woman, Terry Markham, when I was living in Wyoming, who turned to me and helped me understand that I was trafficked. And the difference for me was the amount of, as I said earlier, blame I gave myself, because domestic violence and my own bad choices, that was like, I put that on me. But trafficking, I came to understand consent and coercive control. So what Terry did is she looked at this image I'd created that said domestic violence and my own bad decisions. And she basically looked at it through the lens of consent. Did I consent to what I was made to do? And consent, not like just did I say yes to the first thing and that meant the door was swung open to every other thing. It was it ongoing and enthusiastic consent? Did I really want to be there? Did I consent or did I comply with what was asked of me? And so when I started considering my own situation through the lens of consent, it just sent me on this sort of rocket of like, I must understand consent more. I must understand how this changes things and how we're teaching it in society and how understanding consent not only helps prevent trafficking, it helps prevent abuse and assault and bullying and online predation and all of these things. So That is now my soapbox that I live on top of, is understanding consent.
Well, we're very grateful for that, by the way, because we need more of that in the world. You emphasize the importance of education, obviously, in combating human trafficking. So what are some of the common misconceptions about trafficking that you can share with us today?
The biggest one is that it is that thing that happens over there. Whatever that means to people, I think in North America, we think of it as something that's like, that's not a North America problem, or it's not happening in my town or my city. It's this thing that's happening over there. And that's a myth. It is happening in every place in North America, in every sweet little town. I was trafficked in Oakville, Ontario, and a lot of people think of Oakville as sort of a bit of a paradise. And realistically, there is an underworld. Now, the other myth I will say is that it is the idea of stranger abduction. I constantly see these things that go, it's always through Facebook, of like, I was almost trafficked out of an IKEA, or somebody, you know, put peanut butter on my car window, my windshield. So when I put my wipers on, I had to pull over, and then they were going to snatch me and traffic me. That's not what happens. It's not stranger abduction. That's like 0.01% of cases that I've ever heard of, if that. It is always or almost always someone the victim knows, loves, and trusts.
We're speaking with Alexandra Ford. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back to continue our discussion on sex and human trafficking.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
Okay, we're back with Alexandra Ford. We're continuing our discussion about human and sex trafficking. Alexandra, for people who are listening to our conversation today, and they may be struggling with their own traumas or wondering if perhaps they are currently caught up in a trafficking scheme, what message or guidance would you offer to them today?
Oh, that's a very good question. If your gut, if there's any part of your brain that is telling you even 1% chance you might be being exploited, that's a good chance you need to investigate that further. There is the Canadian human trafficking hotline. I would say put it in your show notes because I don't have the number memorized. But you can call that and ask questions just anonymously to find out more information. And I will say, if at any point you have to shut up a voice in your head that is trying to tell you you don't want to be there, you don't want to do that, you're not having as much fun as the shell of you is telling people you're having, listen to that voice, because that is your heart and soul telling you this isn't where you want to be, and you deserve to have your heart and soul align with your brain, align with what your body's doing.
Let's talk about that path to healing then, because for you, when you realized that you had been trafficked, what work did you have to do to move past that?
Well, I'll say I'm still doing the work, and I probably will be for the rest of my life. I think we often talk about healing as a destination. Like, when did you heal? How did you heal?
Right.
And for some people, in some situations, it may be. For myself, with the amount of trauma starting as young as it did that I've sort of piled on top of each other, I will be healing for the rest of my life. But I have come to realize you can be a mess and a masterpiece at the same time.
Oh, I love that. That's going on a quote somewhere. That's great. I love that.
Thank you. That is honestly something I have to tell myself sometimes 20 times a day. Whether it's in relation to my parenting skills or, you know, my healing journey or whatever it is. And I think to go back to your question, the thing that was the most healing, interestingly enough, was finding out I was trafficked was freedom to me, which is kind of weird because trafficking is the absence of freedom in a lot of ways. But for me, I'd worn shame for 10 years. I hadn't told anybody the details of what I'd done or what had been done to me because I thought of it as all my fault. I got myself into that. You know, I should have made better choices. I was a smart kid who did dumb things. And suddenly when I looked at it, when I was helped and I looked at it through the lens of consent, and I realized that I wasn't to blame for all of that, that was like, oh, and now I can start a healing journey that I'm meant to be on instead of one that I'm trying to shove myself through.
For anybody who wants to support the fight against human trafficking but might not know where to start, what are some practical steps they can take to make a difference?
Love that question. You can, if you want to go online and learn, check out Canadian Human Trafficking, Canadian Center to End Human Trafficking, rather. They have some great tips and downloadables on how you can have this conversation with your loved ones, with your kids. I think the best way to start, very first thing you can do is have conversations, whether if you're a parent with your kids, if you're not a parent, just with family and friends. About consent and what that means and how it's the nuances of it have changed over time. Start watching your shows and movies, you know, new ones to older ones with a more critical eye, you know, older rom-coms where the idea is the guy just like annoys the female lead into falling in love with him. She says no, 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 no throughout the entire movie, but eventually she realizes I was wrong all along and it turns out maybe I do love him. Like, what are we teaching about consent? So I think the first thing you can do is really just start thinking critically about that and some of the media you consume and how it does or doesn't represent consent in a good way. Beyond that, have conversations. Beyond that, you can always donate to organizations who are doing good anti-trafficking work. There are some out there that are better than others. So if you're ever curious, you can always DM me and I can kind of let you know if I know of that organization and what kind of work they're doing. But we have a lot of great organizations in Canada who are working really hard towards ending human trafficking here.
Well, you're being humble because I know you're working really hard too. So I would suggest that people follow you and keep up with you and all that you're doing. You just had a TED Talk that's up online. You're on social media all the time. So where can people connect and follow along with you?
Well, thank you very much. You can find me on Instagram at The Laughing Survivor. My website will be up shortly. So that is www.thelaughingsurvivor.com. And go check out my TED Talk. If you either go to my Instagram, it's linked on there. Or if you just Google Sex is Tricky, Consent is Not on YouTube, you will find my TED Talk. So go check it out.
All right. Thank you very much for joining me today, Alexandra. As usual, you know, we had a discussion a couple of years ago, but as usual, you are a wealth of information. So thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me again, Candace. Come at me, don't tell me I didn't warn you.
It's time to find out what's new in entertainment with Anne Brody. Anne, what do you got for us this week as we continue on our roller coaster of weather in Canada here?
Oh, no kidding, right? We've got William Shatner, a famous megalomaniac, talking for 2 hours in his new documentary. And he's having his 93rd birthday today. And pondering death. And strangely enough, I mean, he just talks. You know what he's like. He's Shakespearean. He's very over the top. And it's a little bit exhausting, but it's also quite hypnotic and maddening and all kinds of things. It's a real adventure and it's a fun watch. So now he claims he's always been alone in his life. He's had 4 marriages. He's got oodles of grandchildren and children and great grandchildren, but he feels alone. Now, how can someone like that feel alone? I don't get it. So And he's pondering his death, of course. And, you know, to me, it feels like performance, not authentic. It's just one of the most perplexing documentaries I've seen. And I mean, he talks about everything. He talks about going into space. He talks about Captain Kirk. He talks about being homeless. And I found it to be raw, scary, wonderful, naked, fast, and hypnotic.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm not going to watch this one. Only because I just find William Shatner so campy. It's so over the top and melodramatic, and it's actually irritating to watch. So I don't think I could sit through the documentary, but for those who love him, You Can Call Me Bill is where, Anne?
In theaters.
Theaters. All right. I did not see that coming either. All right. Let's talk about Queen of My Dreams, because I think this looks really sweet.
It is. It's really quite wonderful. So it concerns a Pakistani-Canadian girl. Well, she was born in Canada, but her family just came over before her birth. Now, she's a lesbian. She's told she's a bad Muslim, but she doesn't really care because she sees Canadian society as being completely different than the way it was at home. So now her mother was a Bollywood star, which is a huge deal in Asia. So a trip to Pakistan is necessitated by a relative's death. So she goes there, she sees a little bit of what her mother's life might have been like, and she embarks on this fantasy about being her and being in Bollywood movies and about her life as it is in Toronto and how much more interesting her mother's life seemed. It's really lovely. It's colorful. It's musical. It's full of imagination. And, you know, I just think that she's a wonderful character to watch, and I'm sure many people will relate to her. So it's I highly recommend it. Now that's in theaters as well.
You know, what struck me just briefly watching the trailer, what struck me was this, you know, realization we all have at some point in our lives that our mothers were actually young at one point. And
right. Isn't that something? Yeah.
We weren't just born our mothers. And it really did come across. I think this is going to be a really sweet, heartstring tugging kind of movie.
It is. And it's kind of exciting too in its own way.
All right.
So it's a treat.
So Queen of My Dreams is where?
In theaters.
Okay, in theaters again. Great. Yeah. All right. All our true crime ladies are going to love this. Let's talk about Homicide.
Oh, yes. This is really cool. Dick Wolf from the Law & Order series has another a series out from the Law & Order franchise, excuse me. And each hour is a documentary on a famous murder in New York. And I'm talking famous. So, and it's all described by the actual investigators. So you're getting a real inside scoop. There was, I'm sure you remember this one, a couple of 13-year-old kids were jailed for murdering a man in Central Park, gutting him and filling him with stones. Yeah. And he sunk to the bottom. Then he came up again. It's just, again, I'm going to use the word perplexing. You don't understand where this instinct comes from these kids, but then you kind of do at the end of it. After all the explanatory work, quite shocking. And then there was a murder. You've heard of the Carnegie Deli. It's a famous tourist trap in Midtown Manhattan. So anyway, there was a murder in that building of five people. Nobody heard a thing, even though the restaurant was packed a few floors below. And so it was a total mystery. The same troop of detectives examined it, and wow, what a story. And fortunately, there was one camera that broke it for them. So, and three more stories, really quite explosive.
Well, you've got these and more over on What She Said Talk, and I want to tell people to go over and check that out this week, because, Anne, I cannot wait to see how you describe three body problem because it is complicated. You and I couldn't even talk about it on the radio. So I'm eager to see how you're going to write this one up. Anyway, Anne, thanks for joining me, and we'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week. Thanks, Candace.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
Storybook Farm Primate Sanctuary in Sunderland, Ontario is a haven of safety and healing, offering freedom from fear to primates retiring from various backgrounds such as biomedical research, zoos, universities, pet stores, and private residences. Dr. Jane Goodall, renowned for her work with primates, has endorsed the sanctuary, highlighting its importance in rescuing and caring for these animals. The sanctuary is currently home to 24 monkeys and lemurs, providing them with a peaceful environment to recover from their past traumas. Executive Director Dinah Liepa of Storybook Farm joins me now. Welcome to What She Said, Dinah.
Hello, thank you.
Can you share a little bit about the mission of Storybook Farm Primate Sanctuary and the impact it has on the lives of the primates you care for?
Yes, we get monkeys from a number of different sources, as you said. Primarily at the moment, the majority of our monkeys come from unregulated roadside zoos where they have been seized by animal welfare organizations because of abuse and neglect that they have suffered at these locations. So, for instance, we have a couple of monkeys who were obviously not fed regularly and so are incredibly anxious when it comes to mealtime, to make sure that they get sufficient food, which they now do twice a day. And another example is a monkey who was kept in a dark hole and did not have access to the outdoors. And now he can come and go as he pleases to go in and out and experience sunshine and wind in his face, perhaps for the first time in his life. We don't know the extent of his history. And that's one of the problems too. They come to us traumatized, and then we deal with the different traumas as best we can.
What are some of the biggest challenges you face in running a primate sanctuary, and what are the most rewarding aspects of this work?
Some of the challenges are we try to create families. We actually have a couple of monkeys who came from one organization and a baby who came from another organization, who was neglected by the troop at the zoo that she came from. And so we had a plan A for the baby to have a mother. That didn't work out. But our plan B worked. And so it's now amazing to see the three of these monkeys living together, grooming each other, chasing each other. The male father figure has arthritis, but now he's running around chasing the baby, Misha, when she misbehaves. And it's having success in those kinds of endeavors that is gratifying to us, that is why we do what we do, to make their lives better, to give them choices, give them freedom that they haven't had before, coming from labs where they've lived in 4-foot square cages to now where they have large enclosures where they can, as I mentioned, come and go freely to go inside or outside, particularly in this gorgeous weather that we're having now. So, and yes, one came to us, she's been a pet all her life. She's 12 years old and now she's learning to be a monkey for the first time in her life, as opposed to being a human pet. So these are the different kinds of traumas that we try to deal with and hope to succeed with.
I imagine one of the biggest challenges you must have is funding Can the public get involved and support the sanctuary's efforts in providing care and rehabilitation at all? Or can they visit?
Yes, funding is always an issue. We don't get funding from any level of government. So we do rely on donations from the public, and we're always applying for grants from different organizations. So people can visit the sanctuary one day a month from April to October. The dates are now set and can be found on our website. We do limit the number of people. It's not a zoo. And everything is done for the monkeys. It's not for the public. We don't shut the animals out when people are arriving in order for them to see them. However, they are very curious. So for the most part, they will come out and like to see who the visitors are.
Wonderful. If people want to know more about you and what you do, how they can help or visit, where can they go to do that and keep up with what you're doing?
You can find more about the sanctuary and the work that we do on social media, Facebook and Instagram primarily. And then also you can visit our website, which will give you even more information. And the website is storybookmonkeys.org.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you for all that you're doing to help these monkeys heal. It's incredible work. So it must be very rewarding for you.
Thank you. It is a labor of love.
In a world where the journey to self-discovery is often a winding road, today's guest, Liz Long, brings a story that resonates with the silent struggles many face but few speak about. At the age of 58, Liz received a diagnosis that would reshape her understanding of her life's challenges and triumphs, ADHD. This revelation, coming later in life, sheds light on the complexities of adult ADHD and the profound impact it can have on one's sense of self and path to healing. Liz's candid sharing in her book, Navigating Storms, How to Find Your True Path When Life Gets Rough, offers not just her personal narrative, but a beacon of hope and resilience for anyone grappling with their own storms. Today, Liz joins me to discuss the emotional journey of her diagnosis, the power of self-acceptance, and how we can all find our way to Freedomville. Welcome to What She Said, Liz.
Thanks, Candace. I'm so happy to be here.
Receiving an ADHD diagnosis at 58 must have been a monumental moment in your life. So can you share what led up to this diagnosis and then the initial impact it had on you?
Yeah, thanks. It came as a bit of a surprise, and also at the same time, it wasn't a surprise, if that makes any sense. It was a fluke. It was a fluke conversation with a good friend of mine who was describing working with a millennial who also had ADD. And some of the challenges and personality traits and methodologies and frustration she was describing in this young woman really hit home. And I was like, wait a minute.
This sounds familiar.
I do that too. And is that really so off or so weird? And you know, we joked about it. And then as we were kind of wrapping up, I said,
maybe I do.
She said to me, well,
maybe you have ADHD.
And so it went from there. You know, I started, as most of us do, with Dr. Google, and I did some online assessments, and recognizing that they're not sufficient or, you know, robust and they're not customized in any way. But I was coming up between 65 and 90% affirmative. So I made an appointment with my doctor. He put me through all of his own assessments and then gave the diagnosis and sent me to a psychiatrist to talk about how I was going to manage it. At first, Candace, I was ashamed. I was like, oh, I was like, wow. And I was discouraged, and I thought, So this all was happening too, right around the time I had decided I was writing a book and I was working on an outline, and I was very frustrated and felt overwhelmed with the organizational task of doing that. It without a doubt was the biggest administrative task that I have conquered solo.
Right.
And I was feeling ill-equipped, and the diagnosis at first, my reaction was, oh, there's no way. There's no possible way I'm ever going to be able to write a book if this is what I have. But when I sat with it for a little while, it actually, and quite quickly, it became a relief.
Interesting.
That knowing, because all of the things that I learned to do, I mean, 58 years, I had to function an adult and raise two kids on my own. And I had a real estate business and I owned houses. And, you know, there was a lot of adulting that had to happen. And I'm not saying it wasn't without a lot of blips and mistakes and oversights, because it sure was. And I came up with a lot of systems and checklists to help me manage that. But at the same time, for all those years, I thought that I was substandard, that my brain was less than, that my focus was not what it should be for an adult, you know? And the diagnosis helped me have some grace and understanding to learn to accept myself, and that it wasn't necessarily a less than thing. That when I looked back over the years and realized that I had that additional challenge that ADD brings, and that I had successfully navigated and come up with ways to accomplish and do all those things, that it actually helped me learn to love myself in a weird kind of roundabout way.
And it feels, though, you know, which is why I was so keen to talk to you, because it feels like I am certainly seeing so many women in my cohort who are currently being diagnosed with ADHD. And I am seeing all kinds of reactions. Like, I love your story, but I am seeing everything from flat out resentment and anger to relief. So what advice would you give someone who's just sort of starting to navigate this new understanding, I suppose, of how their brain actually operates?
I think I would invite them to choose a perspective about it that feels good, because it truly is, it's a choice. I mean, we make up meanings about everything, and we literally make up the meaning. And so that gives us the opportunity to make up a meaning and choose a perspective that's empowering and that feels good. And I mean, they're certainly not alone. None of us are alone in that. Like you say, you know, there's more people joining that club every
all the
day.
Time. Yeah.
So, you know, there's much to be learned from other people and what works for them. Yes. And I would say the biggest thing is to give yourself some grace and acceptance. And it can be a challenge, or it can be a superpower. It can be just a part of who you are. And we can't change that. So
I get the feeling that it's become a superpower for you, because you did indeed write that book.
I did indeed. I got the book done, and I had to employ next level checklists and organization things to manage that feat. And that in and of itself was also confidence building.
And did you, just out of curiosity, when you were diagnosed, did you move to medication, or did you move to other coping mechanisms to help you with your ADHD?
Yes, and I did start taking a dose of Vyvanse, and that certainly helped with the focus of writing and organizing the book. I not a real fan for myself personally of taking a lot of pharmaceutical drugs. And we played around with the dosage a little bit, and it's been reduced a lot. And I certainly don't take it daily. I like the supplement Lion's Mane, and I found that I'm fairly sensitive to that. And so it has almost the same effect for me, and I don't even take that daily. So I have a low dose of Vyvanse if I'm entrenched in a project that is going to require a lot of, you know, sustained deep focus, and Lion's Mane otherwise on occasion. But most of the days I don't take anything.
Because you probably built a lot of coping skills over 58 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, Candace. I did. I have lists and checklists and reminders and systems and the order of operations for all kinds of things. And those are always getting revised and edited and tweaked with every new time I use them almost. So I rely on those. I would be lost without my old school write down day timer. I would literally be lost.
So
without that,
your journey is a really powerful testament to resilience and self-discovery, and you're a joy. I mean, people can't actually see your face right now, but you've been smiling the whole time we're talking. You're obviously a very well-adjusted, happy person. So what message do you hope readers take away from your story, especially those who may be facing their own, as you say it, shitstorms?
In my book, I talk about our journey to come back to and find what I call our heart voice. And that is our internal knowing of who we are and that we are more than enough. And our heart voice will provide all the innate guidance that we need for ourselves. So to trust that. To trust that.
All right. Well, I want people to be able to find you and find the book. So where can they do that?
Thank you. My website is LizLongWrites.com. And my social media handles are Navigating Storms. And my book is available at all the places. Amazon, Audible, Indigo, Barnes & Noble.
All right. Incredible. Liz, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Candace. Have a great day.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
In today's economic climate, where inflation touches every aspect of our lives, managing personal finances and sticking to a budget has become more challenging than ever. Joining me today is Laura Whiteland, a financial expert known for her practical and insightful approaches to personal finance and budgeting. Laura brings a wealth of experience and a unique perspective on how to navigate the turbulent waters of today's economy. Today, we'll dive into strategies for effective budgeting in the face of rising costs and how to maintain financial health without compromising on quality of life. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks so much for having me.
So with inflation impacting everything from groceries to utilities, what are the first steps individuals should take to reassess and adjust their budgets?
Well, I'm actually a bit of a fan of kind of the anti-budget. So actually looking backwards in order to look forwards. So looking at how your finances have maybe changed and adapted over the last few months, 6 months, a year, looking back at your statements and really get a good understanding of how you are spending money. And that can give you a basis to which understanding the decisions you are making. And then that gives you an understanding to then change if you need to, or even just understand where you're at. In a lot of cases, people somewhat intuitively adapt to changing prices. You walk into the grocery store and you're going, I'm not going to buy that. That's too expensive. And you do see a little bit of that, but if you're finding yourself kind of getting behind every month, if you know you're going to need to make changes, but you need to know what you're doing first before you can actually change anything about your finances, people tend to aspirationally budget, and that doesn't always work out very well.
And many people find it difficult to cut back on expenses, even when they know they should. So what are some practical tips you can offer for prioritizing spending in a way that aligns with both needs and financial goals?
I think going in with an idea of what's important to you. So like I was saying about the looking backwards, go through and you say, you know what? I don't even remember some of these transactions. I don't remember what they were about. I don't know why I did it. Those are kind of your easy pickings. That's the low-hanging fruit when it comes to changing the way you budget. And really building up an understanding of why you're making those decisions. Maybe you're making them because you're stressed out or they're an impulse buy. And if you know that I'm not going to care about this a month from now, in the moment, it makes it a little bit easier to maybe not find yourself in those positions. And then when we look at kind of the bigger ticket items, you can see what the patterns of your spending are. And you say, you know what? Maybe we can't afford a trip this year, or we can't, you know, we have to change the way we're looking at some of our budgeting. You know, there's more of these kind of bigger ticket items that keep coming up, you know, the new tires and all of those other things that are going to happen in your day-to-day life that when everything else is more expensive, there isn't room for. So you need to make room for them because you got to get to work. You got to pick up your kids. You got to get through your day.
I have to tell you, one of the biggest ones for me were what I call ghost expenses, are those things that recur monthly that I've stopped paying attention to why I'm paying that. And it adds up when you start to look at these monthly expenses for something that you're not using anymore. So that's a big one for me personally, is finding those. But in your experience, what are some common budgeting mistakes people make during inflationary periods, and how can they avoid them?
I think when I talk about that aspirational budgeting, I think I see two situations. People either go very absolutist. They go, we're in tough times. I got to cut back on absolutely everything. And it's unsustainable. You go from, you know, living your life the way you want to then I can afford absolutely nothing. And you're not going to be able to do that for the next 60 years of your life. So you need to prioritize, you know, actually enjoying life and building a budget that's actually workable for you and that you're not going to go crazy on. The other side of it is kind of the aspirational lifestyle where you go, you know what? I'm going to go and buy a bunch of food at the grocery store, and I'm going to stop eating out, and I'm going to not do this, and I'm going to make my coffee at home. And I always kind of make the joke, you know, if the $5 coffee is what puts you in a good mood to not, you know, lash out at your boss when you walk in the morning, it's worth your whole annual salary. So it's finding those points where you actually do enjoy them. You find value in them, prioritize that, and then start cutting out the stuff that, like you said, those ghost expenses, the things that you buy because you think you're going to use them, but you actually aren't. Or, you know what, are you really going to eat the second, you know, head of celery that's $6 in the grocery store right now? You might hope you're going to, but you might also by Thursday be looking at eating out, and then it goes bad, and then you just kind of wasted the money. Know your own patterns, know your own routine.
How do you recommend people deal with fixed expenses that are rising, such as rent and mortgage, which is, you know, impossible to avoid, and it constitutes a really large portion of everybody's budget?
The hard part is because it is fixed. The reality is you have to adapt around it. You know, you can look at moving, you can look at downsizing if it gets really severe, but if it's really that, like, you know, it's just pushing your budget up, the reality is you have to move around it. And you might have to cut some of those discretionary spending. You might have to reduce the parts of your budget that you enjoy more. And unfortunately, that's just kind of the reality. If you only have so much money coming in and you have so much money that has to go out, then the money that you have a little bit more control over, those are your levers to pull. And, you know, really, if you can prioritize the stuff you aren't enjoying, that makes it easier. But, you know, at some point, it does eventually just get to addition and subtraction, and you need to have enough for the subtraction that is going to be those fixed expenses.
It feels like every single dollar is accounted for anymore. So I'm wondering, where do we find space for savings in all of this? Are there any strategies you have for saving money? Any special accounts, high interest accounts we could be looking at, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is maintaining the discipline of saving. You know, if you're in a hard spot and it's always tempting to reduce your savings when your budget gets tight. And if you do need to do that, again, don't go completely, you know, on and off. Reduce, not remove. It's really hard to get back in the habit of saving once you stop. And you've done the good work. You've put yourself on that track. If you really are at the point where you're like, I can't find another dollar anywhere else in my budget, it's got to come out of savings, then try and be careful with that and make sure that it's temporary. Realistically, the longer you aren't saving as much, the more you will probably have to be saving later if you do have financial goals that you're building towards, which everybody's going to retire, so we all do. So just making sure that it's a balancing act and that, again, you have a plan to maybe get out of that. It needs to be a temporary solution. Savings is part of, you know, making sure you enjoy your life, not just today, but also tomorrow.
And financial anxiety is a very real thing. And inflation is not helping. Do you have any advice you can offer to help people stay calm and focused on their financial goals?
I really think, like I said, that going back and understanding how you do spend money is a bit of an act of introspection, and it allows you to get to know yourself a little bit better. And once you know how you do enjoy your lifestyle and how you do find value in the money that you have, you can then be better acquainted with what you're actually deriving enjoyment out of and finding balance in your own life. So if you have that good understanding, you then, when it gets turbulent and it gets stressful, you know where to fall back to. You're not necessarily having to worry as much about, I don't know what to do. I don't know what's going on, because you have that balance of, you know what, I do know what's going on. I know there might be some hard choices that I have to make, and it's going to be difficult. It might even be painful, but at the very least, I know why I'm doing it. I know like what I'm prioritizing. An example would be, you know, if you're having a hard time with your budget and you want to focus on your kids, you want to make sure that they still get to go to the activities they do. Well, that might mean you have to cut out other things, but you have a reason why. You know why you're doing it. You know where your principles and your values are, and that can make it easier to make those cuts as you're going along.
Let's talk about quickly, just briefly here. There is a lot of interest, I think, in improving financial literacy skills. Do you have any recommendations where people can go to find out more and improve sort of their financial knowledge?
We're actually in a bit of a golden age of how available a lot of financial literacy is. I mean, maybe not so much TikTok and Instagram. Those reels are maybe not as helpful as they people might hope they are. But going in and looking at the government has many different sites and tools that you can look up. The Financial Consumer Agency of Canada is a great source for resources. They have a lot of calculators. Even the CMHC has a lot of great tools for debt and borrowing and mortgages that you can look through and help understand what's going on. So there's a lot of great kind of unbiased, generic resources out there that aren't necessarily tied to the specific products you might have, but can give you a better understanding of how they work overall, and give you the tools that when you are going to look at renewing your mortgage, you know better what your options are. You can go in with a little bit more understanding. The reality is a lot of banks are unfortunately stretched these days. It's hard to get as much time to go through your options. So you do need to have a bit of a background going in. And it can also allow you to look forward and you say, you know what, I know interest rates right now on mortgages are around 6%, and my mortgage is sitting at 3%. When it renews, I'm going to be feeling the pinch. Start making those adjustments now. If you are able to kind of start putting that money aside or pay down a little bit more on your mortgage rate before you have to renew, then you're better prepared when you have to be paying more. So it's about looking forward, going in with a good understanding, and kind of build up your repository of skills.
All right, excellent. And how can people find you, Laura?
You can find me on my website, inclusivefp.com. That's for my business. And you can find me at Laura Whiteland on Instagram, LinkedIn, and same with Inclusive Financial Planning. So we try to put out some information, some blogs, and as much helpful skills as we possibly can.
All right, incredible. Thank you so much for joining me today, Laura. This was very helpful.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for What She Said this week. Stay up to date with our newsletter by signing up at whatshesaidtalk.com and be sure to follow on social at What She Said Talk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for videos of these interviews and more. You can also catch me on TikTok at Candace Said. Finally, be sure to subscribe to What She Said with Candace Sampson on Apple and Spotify to catch past episodes and extended podcasts. I'll be back next week with another What She Said on 105.9 The Region.
Previous episodes of What She Said on 105.9theregion.com.